Today's episode of the show, I want to welcome back a longtime guest at this point, John McClernand. John is our North of the Border friend, and he's got quite a few stories to give us today. One, of course, being he's a new father once again. Got two little boys running around the house now, and we all know what that brings. On top of that, we're going to be talking a little bit about some Canadian policy in regards to the fact that if you pay attention to trends, you might notice that a lot of the, it seems like, testing waters of policy coming into the United States actually comes from Canada. You know, of course, a lot of it is tested out in Europe as well and brought over here. We're going to get to talk about that, talk about some of the ramifications of policy going down slippery slopes. And I think it's an interesting conversation, especially as we start to open it up to the world view and taking a look at everything that's going on around us, especially when it comes to multiple wars now going on at the same time around the world. Be a part of this conversation. I want you to let me know what you thought of the show. I had a blast doing it, and why don't we get right into it?
Get something out of the way and kind of break the ice a little bit. It's great to have you back, John. It's been, ever since we started, it's been about once a year, and I'd love to keep that or even increase the volume because I love doing our shows together. It's fun to see an over the border from Canada perspective, as you guys seem to be our brethren.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. Well, last time we chatted, I had one kid, now I've got two. So I've doubled my parenting duties.
Oh boy. And how has that been?
Well, I love doing it a second time. I mean, each kid is unique and different. The challenge, as you probably can guess, like the first kid having 2+ years of solo parent attention from both parents to all of a sudden divided attention from his other little human. Thankfully, he hasn't tried to like take out his younger brother. He actually kind of likes his younger brother.
Good.
Which is good. But instead he like kind of rejected my wife pretty hard. He, you know, cause mama was
really?
His world. And then all of a sudden her attention was like divided. And so it's like, well, now, because I'm hurt by this, I'm gonna reject you. So that was pretty tough on my wife. And so then it becomes like data is everything, which on the one hand is kind of nice to sort of get that, but then it's kind of like, well, I want to do everything. Like, I don't want you to go to work. I want you to dress me or all this kind of stuff. And it's like, hey kid, like, I love you and I love the attention. I love being.
I was gonna ask what the strain was on you, and it seems like a lot of the attention got thrown at you. That's interesting. Has it started to balance out a little bit where he's starting to understand why mom is not able to give as much attention as before?
Yeah. And he comes around whenever he actually needs her. Like if he takes a tumble and like bumps his head or something, it's like
he knows where to go in that situation. Yeah.
You're up, mom. So the two different personalities are fascinating to see. It's interesting. So my second son at this time is about 8 months old. And so it was interesting to sort of kind of predict, like looking at how he behaves right now and go, okay, like this one's different. So the first one, we called him the inspector when he was a baby because he would just crawl around and he would find like the tiniest little thing and zero in on it. So attention to detail is really important to him. Like he's very, very precise. He's got a bunch of toy cars and like he'll line them all up, like park perfectly side by side and all this kind of stuff. And number two, I get a sense he's going to be a wrecking ball. Like, He is built like thick and like a wrestler, like just thick and strong, like quite a bit, I think stronger than my first one was at the same age. And so I'm actually kind of, I'm like, oh, like, is he going to like grow up bigger and stronger than his older brother and like wail on him or something? So thankfully he's a pretty happy kid. Like smiles almost all the time until he's hungry or tired. Then he just switch flips and then all hell breaks loose. And he can give like the most heart-wrenching, anguished cry that is just like, oh my gosh, did someone yank your arm off, kid? Oh no, you're just mad because I put you down. But it's hard to know in the moment, right? So
absolutely
learning sort of juggle that. And so my wife and I are doing, I hate the term, but we call it like a bit of a sleep divorce, where I'll sleep in the spare room so that I take care of like the oldest one and she takes care of the baby, so we're not both getting woken up every time one of them wakes up, so that we have like some hope of like getting a little bit of sleep. So
having two that young. So is your first son, is he three yet, or is he turning three soon?
He just turned three. Okay. So that part of it is it's a challenge. But I loved 1 to 2 and even 2 to 3. Mm-hmm. And but I feel like I'm enjoying the baby stage more, because the first time life was just like flipped on its head and we were just so exhausted and trying to figure this whole thing out. Like, yeah, there's
right now you guys kind of have an attack strategy.
Right. And so and I'm because I'm an older dad, I look at like it's sort of said like older parents smell the flowers a bit more, and it's true. Like I'm kind of aware that this could be my last time around having a baby. And so really trying, I just want to be able to, like, obviously we can't hold on to it. I want to be able to say, like, I cherish these moments. I really tried my best to just cherish and love as much as I could.
It's very admirable.
There's nothing like, yeah, there's nothing like a baby just belly laughing. It mm-hmm. is probably one of the greatest like joys that life has to offer is because there's no filter, right? It just, lets fly.
Oh yeah,
and just starts laughing his head off, and he's got like 2 teeth, and his top 2 have just kind of come out. So, oh, it's incredible. And so, the only problem is it comes out. Both of my kids, they're night owls. They take after their mom. So you know, for number one, the oldest, we try to put him down. Between 7:30 and 8. At 10:30, mm-hmm. he's still like up. You know, and I'll go in, and he'll ask me to go in. And we'll sing some songs together, which is actually like pretty sweet. I'm like, I'm not going to regret going in at like 9:30 at night and holding him in my lap and singing with him.
Sure.
I'm you know, but at the same time, like, kid, you're supposed to be asleep. Like, I want to sleep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like 10:30, 11 o'clock, both of them, like, cuteness, like, they flip it up to like level 11. And so, and then if they catch sight of each other, they'll like egg each other on, like, give each other looks and like,
okay,
each other. And like, oh, I mean, it's both the best, and it's like, I also want sleep.
Exactly.
So,
how is that, has it affected your work life at all?
I would just say I've probably scaled back a little bit because I'm trying to, and I work for myself. And so
absolutely.
I've really kind of, I want to say, put things on into cruise control a little bit, where I'm not really trying to grow or anything like that. I'm just, I want the flexibility to be there to help out where I can.
Absolutely.
To just have time with my kids, because it's like, this is the time I don't get back. And then like when they're in school and stuff, I'll like probably scale back up again. But right now, all I want to do is like get the most time I can with my wife and kids at this stage of life.
That, I mean, like I said before, but I'll say it again, it's very admirable. And it's nice to have that perspective of a pretty new and going right through the middle of it, dad, on the show. And again, you being from Canada, it's very interesting. How did you, not to take away from what the middle of the show is going to be about, but how did you enjoy how did you enjoy the experience with the healthcare aspect and the, I guess, does your wife work anymore, or is she stay-at-home mom? Like, how's
that? So the one I will say, you know, universal healthcare certainly has its issues, and I kind of partly wish we had a 2-tiered system where you could pay to skip the line, basically, because it would take people out of the public queue and actually shorten the public queue. But there's far too much outcry. It's not fair. I'm like, yeah, life isn't fair. Get over it. If we had a private system where people could like pay their way out of the queue, kind of thing. Anyways, but
well, that's actually an interesting topic to talk about in of itself, and we should probably save that either later for this show or a later show, because that's an interesting possibility even for a fix to the system in the United States, for example.
Yeah, I think it's similar idea, right? Universal healthcare. I mean, so my wife gets up to 18 months mat leave, which is incredible.
That's actually amazing. And I mean, as much as it might be a burden on the company, but to be able to provide that time for a mother and their kids, that's incredible.
Yeah, I now that I'm a parent, like, and I think like one of the greatest things we have going for us is like parents who can be present in their children's lives. It is so important that I'm willing to pay more taxes to have that as a part of society.
Right? Like,
that for me is worth it. You know, so she, you can do 12 months and then extend it by 6 months. And that's kind of what we did. We'll say we'll take 12 months. And then at 12 months, we'll decide if we want to extend or not. Yeah, it's awesome. And look, it gives someone like a year up to 18 months of experience in a role too. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm for it.
I mean, that sounds like an absolute benefit, and I'm glad to hear that, because you don't get to hear that perspective too much in America, because people are dealing with it the other way around.
Well, I hear like people get like 4 weeks and 6 weeks of mat leave. Like, I'm like, are you insane? Like, just like a woman's body recovering from pregnancy is, oh man, like Now that
you're talking about twice, you're talking about months, if I'm not mistaken. I've been through it, so yeah. I'd be relying on you 100%.
I mean, I don't think you'll go through pregnancy.
But I won't myself. Yeah. I haven't had to witness it firsthand.
Yeah. It's something. Like, I tell you what, my respect from others just keeps going up in that regard, because it's just phenomenal what a woman's body goes through to do that. And then on top of that, it's like your body's just gone through this. You're already exhausted from going through like the birthing process. And then you have this little human 24/7 who wants your attention, doesn't follow your sleep schedule, wants to nurse, chomps on your nipples. Like, it's just, oh man, it's tough. And so like for me to kind of be able to be there for her and for her to have that mat leave, like it's, yeah, your her pelvic region like is totally not recovered in like 4 weeks or 6 weeks. Like, it's just,
yeah, that's just incomprehensible.
And then just like the, like, who are you going to hand your baby off to? Your six-week-old baby? Like, they don't even know who I am for, like, the first couple months. Like, they're aware that there's this other human in the house. But, like, mom is everything. And so I think, like, mat leave should be 6 months at a minimum. Because
I would be in support of that. It takes you about
4 months or so for the baby to start recognizing that I'm dad. Like, that I'm someone that's important relative to mom. Mm. And so you think at 6 weeks, handing that child off just like someone else now. Like, unless it's necessary because the mother has like some serious issues that make her unfit to be a mother, like 6 months. That's my thing.
And what would you, because we're on the topic, what would you support for, I guess, maybe not necessarily dad staying home, but should they get time off?
They should, probably for the first 4 weeks. Okay. It's different, like, because still, regardless of how society has changed, like, the biggest thing that men can do is be providers. It's like,
right.
That's what we do well.
And it's important for our psyche.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I think just 4 weeks, it might be different when people have, like, family support. Like, if they have parents around, like, grandparents, they can come over and kind of help out and stuff like that. Pardon me, but my parents are, like, at a kind of a stage in life. They're older as well, where they can come around for, like, maybe an hour or something like that. But it's kind of tiring on them. And
you're,
so
you're not going to leave them for a babysitting operation.
No, I don't think my dad can handle the stress. My boys like love him. They love grandpa, and he's physically capable, but I think he just, right. he just gets stressed at that stage.
When he starts crying. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So if you have like family support, that changes it a little bit, but we didn't really have that. And first one we had through COVID, so we really didn't have it.
Yeah. Then everybody separated.
Yeah, and just for the dad to bond with the baby, get skin on skin time, all that kind of stuff. Like, it's, yeah, four weeks at least.
Yeah, I appreciate that take, though. Takes me into, I mean, this whole conversation that we started is really cherishing the fact that life is to be procreated and nursed by a loving couple.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to transform it, as sad as it is, to pretty demented topic, in my opinion, the fact that we even have to talk about something like this, but it originates from your country. And unfortunately, I'm going to put you on the stand for it, because to me, it doesn't make any sense. For anybody who doesn't know where I'm going with this, it doesn't make any sense how a country or any part of a country, because I'm not well-versed in this topic, but how they can legally push for a suicide option to life. And this is not necessarily for terminally ill people, because you can make possibly a good argument for someone who was told at 25 that you're going to die in a month. Not so much when you're talking about someone with depression, in my opinion. So I'd like to discuss this with you. And how did this even become a thing?
Yeah, that's a hard one to know. I know there's a lot of people who are concerned about the slippery slope thing, and it's a very real thing. I'm a Christian, so I have a hard time with like assisted suicide to begin with, because the question is that doctor technically carrying out murder?
I agree 100%, but talking just as logistically as we can without involving religion, because me and you both would probably side on the same part there.
Yeah.
It's still disturbing to me to have the government, if we're going to say government shouldn't have a hand in carrying out the law and justice in retribution and using murder as a technique, how are you justifying someone who is just asking to die and the government giving the AOK?
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned like capital punishment, because there are some instances where I have a tough time with anybody who would be committing murder technically to carry capital punishment, but there could be a case made for that too. But the idea that we disallow capital punishment.
That's where I was going.
Suicide, right? It actually doesn't make a lot of sense. But then there's a lot of things that our current government is doing that doesn't make a lot of sense. A lot of people. But yeah. Here's the issue that we kind of bump into is we go, yeah, we can like yell and shout and all this kind of stuff, but it doesn't seem to have any effect. Like I've had this conversation with another friend of mine down in the U.S. who went from being like fairly right-leaning to I'll probably never vote Republican again kind of thing. And it's been this interesting journey that he's been over the last.
Has it been through COVID? Because that would be an interesting time frame. Yeah. COVID turned me away from full bore conservatism. 100% it did.
Yeah. So, and you're, I think, south of the border, like your whole sort of political dichotomy there, where there's like, seems to be like no room for nuance and increased sort of tribal division and stuff like that. Like,
oh no. And at this point, Trump Biden, it's not even a right left thing. Well, it hasn't been right left for a while and I'm not really a subscriber to that, but it hasn't even been Republican Democrat. It's been Trump Biden or Trump X, Trump Y for the past 8 years. It's getting, it's getting to a point of boiling over. People are just tired of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So how we got to that place is, I don't know. I mean, I think there's probably some element of conspiracy to it because like wherever there's smoke, there tends to be a bit of fire. We have an overburdened healthcare system as it is. Why don't we expand this? Where people who don't want to be a part of our population, well, we can just kind of let them die and let them make that request. I have no evidence, no hard evidence to say that, but just kind of studying human behavior. And then I work in the field of health, like proactive healthcare as like a health coach and kind of looking at like the overall health of our population. And the burden is, you know, we were talking about universal healthcare and a lot of the benefits of it. The downside is like, it's an incredibly burdened system. And so the cost is getting astronomical.
By being universal. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you look at like south of the border, like you guys are, your state of health is even worse than ours as a population, we'll say.
And, if you look at the statistics, it's abysmal for our entire country.
Yeah. And it might like sink your economy and it's probably close to doing that. Which is crazy to think about. So
well, COVID in really sense, showed.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of weirdly, it makes sense to go, hey, like if you think a certain way, I should say, just to preface this, well, why don't we let people like unburden our healthcare system? Why don't we just let them like choose to die? And we live in this weird time of life or era of life where, you know, we're like basically, hey, you can kind of do and imagine like anything you want. Like, so, you know, without getting too sidetracked into things like gender ideology, which is like the sort of the extreme end of this, but it's another example of the slippery slope. We look at this where it's like, hey man, you do you, whatever that looks like. Oh, you want to die? Cool. You do you. But it's like, what does that say about the values of a population?
Well, I think that's a great point to make though, because I think that's the end of the road when you're looking at full expression, when you're going to allow, I don't want to say that you should shut down full expression, but when you're going to decentivize people from correcting that speech by way of when you hear someone saying, I want to kill myself, and you have the natural combat to that of someone coming, supporting that person, saying, you do not need to die. You're worth something to this world. Right. And when someone gets looked down upon for being that interjecting person, which is what our society does nowadays, I'll bring up an example of the man, I forget his first name, but it was something petty. And he was just a bystander on the subway in New York and was noticing a man harassing women, harassing everybody around him, but specifically women about to assault them. Well, actually to batter them. They had already been verbally assaulted. And he stepped in and he stopped the situation physically, just like you would expect any grown man who was taught and raised by a good father and mother combo. You protect the society and women around you, especially when you notice a threat. And the man that was underneath him died by his force or not, really is, to me, beside the point. The fact that he stepped in and protected these people is heroic. But he's now in jail. And I believe he's going to have to appeal his case, and most likely doesn't look like he's winning, because our society has changed its view on actually having a corrective force, a full use of that expression of not just speech, but like I said, if you're going to allow one side or one total dereliction of society, you have to allow the counterbalance, in my opinion. And we're getting away from that. It's tending one direction.
I mean, and I think this is kind of just fascinating as a whole. And maybe you take a step back and you go, who benefits from like interest of civil anarchy?
I love this question. Oh, I love it.
Because that's kind of where we're going to, is this idea of like, I'll call it like civil anarchy, because I don't, not necessarily in a governmental sense, but it's more like government enabled, where they're like, okay, we'll let people kill themselves, and then we'll let people like get violent with each other and fight with each other. Then you go like, yeah, who benefits? And I'm like, the people who are looking down, watching, like someone once made the comment, we're all players in someone else's video game. And I
was just thinking about it like a chess situation, and we're the pawns. That's exactly how I feel about it. Now, to us, you would think if you're in that situation, you're expendable. And I think you're right in where you're heading. And I couldn't agree more. Right? There's a lot of different angles you could take with it, a media angle or a population control angle, because that seemed to be a hot button issue within the last 15 years. But yeah, so I'm curious now, we could tie it right back into speech. Do you think this starts with a slippery slope of speech, or do you think it's been a slippery slope of a lot longer lasting issues than that? Because I remember, you know, specifically someone like Jordan Peterson calling out the increased policing of speech on college campuses being a slippery slope, and that might have been in 2015, 2014. It was a long time ago.
This has been going on even longer than that. And just to quickly touch on Mr. Peterson, another Canadian who I think is a national treasure. I don't agree with everything he says, but I still think he's a national treasure.
Absolutely. Especially lately since the poor guy had his issues with, what was it, benzodiazepine or something? Like that.
You know, I think the challenge with someone like Jordan Peterson is when you are like such a deep thinker like that, and so in one sense intelligent, that when you start to like look down the road and you start putting two and two together, life seems pretty dark. And maybe he's making some connections that are unlikely to take place. I'm not sure, but he definitely seems more negative than before, where he was more, I would say, like valiant and challenging. So nonetheless, kind of in that vein, though, it's like I understand why he sort of is in this the throes of this sort of existential angst about where society is heading, because he's sitting here and he's looking at all this with his brain and his perspective on life and his understanding of human psychology, and going like, I kind of see where this is going. I mean, I think the slippery slope started decades earlier. Really, probably you could probably trace it back to the 60s, which is kind of where the beginning of like, let's just start like unshackling ourselves from sort of basic standards of human decency and move closer in this direction of hedonism. Because if it feels good, is it really that bad?
So you're thinking like the hippie movement. You're thinking about the turning around of I don't want to necessarily say the civil rights, but what that opened up after the passing of the Civil Rights Act and the different stemmings to specifically something like the LGBT community, which now is all encompassing I mean, we've talked about it on multiple shows at this point.
it's now like seriously propagandized, and
even people who are a part of that community are outright letting you know, and they don't like it a lot as well, on how much their community's gotten eaten by activists.
Yeah, and now to be fair, like as a Canadian, I think I have, you know, I support in a sense like human rights.
Absolutely.
We don't have, I think, the same, we're not innocent, but we don't have the same degree of, I'll say, intense racist past that like the U.S.
Ingrained into your country with a civil war. We'll put it that way.
So when I talk about like the slippery slope and starting back then, I'm not really talking about it from race perspective. I'm talking from a human behavioral perspective, where it's like, hey, let's kind of loosen the shackles on sexual behavior and see where this goes. And there was this idea that, okay, like, hey, free love, let's just have more free sex. And we know that like sex primarily was for procreation for most of human history. And now it becomes like the pursuit of pleasure. And I think the pursuit of pleasure itself is a slippery slope. Mm-hmm. And so it, whatever element of society you apply this to is like, hey, let's unshackle the pursuit of pleasure. And then you keep moving us forward in a society that's becoming more and more technologically advanced, where we can sort of tap into most of our hedonistic desires, like whatever we can imagine, we can basically create some way to feed into that with the advances of technology. And, you know, this is another side topic, but like the advent of AI, which intelligence is sort of a, I don't know, questionable term for people in the know, but I know why they use that term, right? I'm saying right. Like it's a massive search engine with a lot of like algorithmic guides that can compute some incredible things. But anyways, the point of like where all of this computing power is going and things, it's like, it started with just the unshackling of like, hey, let's put some boundaries around our human behavior. Because along with like mm-hmm. the free love was like, hey, let's all smoke weed. You know, I think there's some, you know, some case for
deeper drugs as well, or harder hitting drugs as well.
And we could probably make a case for the judicious use of marijuana products in certain cases. But the idea that it's totally benign is way off the mark. Absolutely. There are some real long-term health ramifications of utilization of it. Hey, if someone's dying of cancer and they want to smoke weed, I'm like, you know what? Whatever, man. At that point, if you're terminally ill and you want to smoke weed, I'm like, okay, I'm not so worried about the health ramifications because you're already dying, you know, and whatever, you know, that's my whatever, man. That's when that comes into play for me. But so this unshackling sort of thing, that's kind of started. And then you look at, there was that sort of sexual revolution. And then in the 80s sort of came about like the homosexual revolution. And then in the early 2000s really started the expansion of what I'll call like the, respectfully, the alphabet community, because I just can't keep up with all the letters that are out there at this point in time. Like I just can't.
Nope.
And again, I'm not opposed to human decency and treating people with compassion. Like I'm not against that. I'm not saying these people deserve to die for whatever sort of nature they're born with. I don't mean that. But it's like every imagination that we can sort of come up with is like being brought into fruition. The pursuit of pleasure, the end of that is death. So this almost ties back to this assisted suicide concept here.
Absolutely.
And I know we want to keep this more political, but if I could just use a biblical reference here, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
I look at the words of Jesus, and I believe that the commandments he gave, inspired by God, were intended to improve our quality of life naturally as well. And so the commandment that I often think about is this one of self-denial, to practice self-denial, essentially to actively or purposefully deny yourself the pursuit of pleasure. Now, it doesn't mean to live a life of misery. Like, people can take that way out of context and go, yeah. I mean, look, Jesus made wine and had celebrations and things like that, right? It's not like he had a life that was pure misery. But why would we be instructed to practice self-denial? And it's because of this understanding of, like, the human psyche, that the pursuit of pleasure and how that actually works neurologically in our brain and psychologically is that there is no way to fully satisfy that. So I'll give you a real simple example. You start drinking coffee, but pretty soon coffee is not quite enough. So maybe you throw a little bit of ephedrine in there to try and keep you going. Then pretty soon ephedrine is not quite enough. And then, okay, now I'm going to maybe add some more questionable stimulants in there because I built up a tolerance to this and so on. And at the end of the road is like meth or cocaine if you're rich, right? Like,
sure.
And the end of that road is death, right? Mm-hmm. So the unrestrained pursuit of pleasure, the end of that road is death. And that was what, if you know, that's why I believe there was a commandment given to practice self-denial. Because like, if you don't deny yourself, if you don't purposefully and intentionally say, hey, I will restrain myself from the pursuit of pleasure in all instances, the end of that road is just death. And so maybe that actually brings us to this place where people think that like, hey, well, I just want to get off this life.
Easier way out.
I've gotten all the pleasure I can get out of this life. All that's probably left for me is misery, you know? So I don't know.
I love the way that conversation came full circle, though, because this is why I wanted to bring it up in the first place. It all ties together when you really look at it. And I think it a major thing to look back, if it wasn't the start of it, is still the censoring of speech. Because at the end of the day, I genuinely believe that when something is that bad that it needs to be addressed, if you don't have the ability to address that with full confidence, you're not going to be arrested. You're not going to be stomped by the other political side, which is a very real threat nowadays. If you're going to go try to stand on a public square and preach what you believe to be truth.
Yeah.
I believe that if you're in a society that is at that point of policing speech, you're at that slippery slope point where you might not be able to scratch your way back up. I think it does come down to it. And you're talking about people killing themselves, maybe through the government. But if you noticed over here, we've had two people in the past couple months burning themselves alive.
Right. Yeah.
Politically motivated. Protest.
Yeah.
Politically motivated. Which, as well.
Blows my mind. Yeah. You know, like if you were under a regime, like extreme regime, like let's say the Chinese Communist Party, I could maybe understand an act like that.
Sure.
I feel like, you know, what do I have left? But in the current climate in the US, that seems like mind boggling that somebody would get to the place where that's what they would carry out. So I want to go back to this idea of like stifling speech a little bit here.
Yes.
I don't know if I would say I'm a free speech absolutist, but I think there are, like, because there's laws like the whole you can't cry fire in a crowded theater, right?
Yep. That's a big gotcha. That's a big gotcha, but yes.
Right. But outside of that, I'm pretty open to like ideas being debated in the public square. But here's where we encounter a challenge with technology. Technology doesn't have our best interest in mind, right? So
correct. Look
at algorithmically. What shows up for us on whatever social platform you might be on?
It's whatever's going to make you engage.
The most emotive. And typically, what's going to make you angry? Because we are more inclined to act or
you're going to engage and more likely actually comment, which is the biggest driver of attention.
How many people write a lengthy post because they saw like a cute puppy like running through the grass in slow motion? Like, hey, that warms my heart as much as anybody, but I'm not going to write a 10 paragraph post on how that warms my heart. I might just go, oh, that's cute, heart, and carry on. But on the other hand, I'll give an example again. Someone posted a meme about Deuteronomy, I want to say like 28 and 15 or something like that, an Old Testament law verse, and was basically using it as saying like, hey, you believe in this God here that says like if a man rapes a woman, she has to be married to him and she can't actually divorce him, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't that angry about that, but I was like, hey, that's taken out of context. And I took the time to engage with this individual, an acquaintance of mine, and say, let me throw some context your way and see what you think about that, you know? And so it's like when something, as a Christian, I'm like, hey, I don't like seeing something taken out of context and slandered. I want to offer another perspective. I was willing to engage because it was something that was like, let's say, quote unquote, attacking my belief system. I didn't feel particularly threatened by it, but that's what we find is when something maybe attacks our sense of identity or attacks our belief system, we're more inclined to want to engage with it. So we're going to be fed that stuff. And then the crappiest ideas, the most conspiratorial, because could you imagine, for example, like, hey, nanobots are going to, like from an injection, are going to climb into your brain and take over your brain. That's a terrifying thought.
Yes.
The actual reality, like, there's no part of me that believes that's possible, right? But could you imagine?
Yeah.
Like the thought of that is so terrifying that of course you're going to, you know, so those are the kinds of ideas that end up rising to the top. I'm like, I'm kind of like a centrist. My slippery slope is not falling into nihilism and just not caring. And thankfully I have children to stop me from doing that. I love my kids so much that like, I want to, you know, but to not fall into nihilism, just not caring and being like, you know, do whatever the hell you want. I'm going to go make a cabin in the woods and be a hermit. You know, maybe if I didn't have a family, I might actually be tempted to do that, but instead I'll engage in society.
Absolutely.
So sorry, I know I was sidetracked a little bit, but the free speech idea here, technology is a different ballgame because of what rises to the top and gets fed to people and influences people and so on. So I go, okay, I don't know that unfettered speech on social platforms is a totally good idea. The other hand, I don't like one predominant ideology controlling the filter, like right or left. And you know, most platforms seem to be pretty left-leaning because they're the more hedonistic political ideology. So I don't like them controlling the filter, but I think that there should be some controls in place. I just don't have any good ideas as to what that should actually look like.
If I was to just interject, what would never happen, but I do think is a reasonable solution, is that the policy of these companies, because in reality, there needs to be, I believe, a Supreme Court case in the United States determining whether they are publishers or whether they are platforms.
Right.
If they are a platform, it should be pretty clear that they do not have the company. Yes, they have the right to run the servers. Yes, they have the right to have their data, whatever they need. However, the pertinent information needs to be shared directly with the authorities that are, as much as I hate the police overview aspect, stuff that is pertaining to law enforcement needs to automatically be fed. So there's no political games, right, left, who's in charge or whatnot. And not only that, they're not allowed to police the speech, but our Congress is. If they were to actually, you know, because that is allowable by law in our country, they are allowed to pass laws based on what we are actually allowed to say, believe it or not. That's right. Where, because then we have, as a people, we have a right to vote on it. Now, might be through our fiat system, but that is the only way, in my opinion, you get anywhere with these, because they're all centered, really, business model-wise, in America. They're going to try to do their business for Americans to get them to engage. Mm-hmm. That's the only way that I see it, because otherwise these companies have too many interests that are money incentivized and not user incentivized. Like, I always think back to that quote, and I'll let you go off. I always think back to that quote. I'm sure you've heard it before, where they call you a user for a reason. What other business treats you as or calls you a user? And, you know, I shouldn't have to answer that for you, but a drug dealer, right? They call their people users. Right. Why are these platforms calling their people users? And we willingly accept it, but go ahead.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the great books of our time was Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport, because he called all this stuff out. He was like, let me tell you what they're going to do for you. And he's the author of, more famously, like, Deep Work. And I think he has a podcast called Deep Thoughts. But he's called out exactly what these platforms are doing. But again, the problem is almost like how our brain is wired, right? Do you know the analogy of the elephant, the rider, and the path, talking about our brain?
Explain it to me.
So we have, like, a fast brain. We'll call it, like, an emotional, impulsive, reactive kind of brain.
Hmm.
And then we have a slow brain. Let's say thinking, the calculating, let's weigh the consequences of choices and things like that. And then we have the environment. And so what this analogy is stating is, like, your thinking brain is like the rider, your emotional brain, your impulsive brain is like the elephant, and then your environment is the path.
Mm.
Now, when everything's calm, the rider can steer the elephant, right? So the thinking brain can steer the emotional brain. The emotional brain might like go, oh, and then the thinking brain is, hang on a sec, like, now that I've caught up, it's going to be okay. But if the elephant gets really, like, pissed off, angry, scared, frightened, whatever, no amount of shouting from the rider is going to bring the elephant back under control.
Mm.
So that's kind of the brain that we have, where our emotional impulsive brain works a lot faster than our thinking brain does. And social media preys on that aspect of our psychology, that, like, the emotive brain is quite a bit faster than the thinking brain. And obviously, for any neurologists and psychologists out there, I understand I'm simplifying the brain, and this analogy is imperfect, but
that's the point of the analogy. I appreciate it.
It gives us a framework to relate to it, where we go, this is what they're doing, is they're preying on this. But it's because the elephant is powerful and strong, like, it actually then takes, like, conscious thought to try to, like, go realize, like, what's actually happening. But when we live in a world where we're shown, like, 24/7, like, terrible events happening in and around the world that we have absolutely, we feel totally helpless to control. I mean, how many conflicts are being fought right now?
Since the last time we started, but there has been another war that started since the last time we talked.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it depends how we define a war versus, like, a regional conflict. I mean, sure. Basically, you've got Eastern Europe and the Middle East, we'll say, and all the Africa conflicts that nobody talks about because people don't care enough. I would say, like, media organizations can't make enough money to publish. Yeah,
there's just not enough people, I would think, that are going to buy in. If you do know what's happening, it is bizarre to see how many different hotspots there is in the world right now. And of course, you always have China looming with Taiwan. Yeah. And I don't know if it will ever come to military, but it is a threatening situation to our economy specifically.
Oh yeah. To be fair, I actually thought that would have happened by now.
I did too.
I thought the Biden administration.
Well, yeah. I would say, actually, I didn't think it would happen just yet. I'm actually of the belief, as scary as this is, by the end of the summer, there's no way they let it get all the way to the election, because it can influence the election too much. It's going to be haywire.
Right. And it could very well be. I think that, I mean, going back to algorithm and speech and all this kind of stuff, TikTok being controlled by China, controlling the minds of young Americans and things like that, and them not realizing, like, I mean, in one sense, I have an element, I want to word this carefully, because it'd be raised to take it out of context, an element of respect for how dedicated the Chinese Communist Party is to their cause. I am entirely ideologically opposed to what the stances that they take.
Exactly where you're coming from. And to be honest with you, anybody who can appreciate history, I think, would side with you there. Because, well, unless you're an absolute vehement opponent of them, I guess I could get it. But the amount of time, the amount of patience that they've shown with this, I forget what they call it now. They've had so many plans or year plans or whatever.
But, the thousand-year plan, the slow creeping war. Right. Like,
but the
economically,
how they are getting their getting their hands on basically every continent at this point in the world and just funneling basically our money and using it to get kickbacks on their own right. It is incredible, the system that they set up specifically in Africa. And like you said, it's a lot of respect for, or at least how I view it, a lot of respect for the patience that they've had for their plan actually turning over and slowly creeping them up through this, you know, number one effector of economics in the world, which I think is soon to happen. Yeah. I would say within my lifetime.
Their patient positioning, it's like a begrudging respect. Coupled with kind of a sense of horror if their plans come to like very real fruition.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a gravely concerning situation, but this is the thing is while we've been busy pursuing pleasure, it almost here brings it back. Well, pardon me. While we've been like pursuing hedonistic pleasure, China's not been doing that.
Correct.
Right. They've put that aside. I hate how they've gone about it. I'm very firmly in opposition to that and to how they carried this out. Like literally trying to put restrictions on like kids being able to play video games and things. I don't think video games are great, but you know, that kind of stuff. But the fact is that they've just been creeping decade after decade, get people into institutions, set up institutions, like their propaganda, their economic like weaponry, like just lining everything up will slowly under, like Russia had this figured out too. It's just that Russia was never big enough, to be fair.
Right.
Like Russia's a big player, but they've never been big enough. They just aren't. So China has been like slowly undermining like U.S. culture for a very, very long time in ways that you don't really notice, like inch by inch, but you add inch by inch, day after day, decade after decade, and all of a sudden it's like they've gained a ton of ground. And so while undermining the U.S. culture, watching the U.S. get unhealthier, mentally, physically unhealthier, which means your military is, and so on. I guess the one upside to kids playing video games is you might have a lot of fat drone pilots, but they were really good at it, I guess.
They should be pretty decent at the joystick, yeah. Yeah.
Right. So like, maybe that's like what the U.S. still has, right? But like the moment that China like decides they're going to cross the Taiwan Strait, like all bets are off, right? We're now engaged in a hot war. And you and I know this because of the semiconductor industry in Taiwan.
Correct.
That would just literally, that'll cripple the U.S. And the U.S. hasn't done anything about this vulnerability.
No. If anything, by not doing anything, they've fallen into a worse position.
Yeah. Having to do with love of money, above all things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because China was using like their currency manipulations to massively accumulate U.S. dollars and then be able to control like the U.S. economy, you know. Now, like they're, and again, I recognize this is an oversimplification because they couldn't just dump all the U.S. dollars and totally tank the economy. That would hit them pretty badly too. But they kind of are holding onto your balls as a country.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, okay, crushing them is not like in our best interest, but giving a little squeeze and making you go ow. We're gonna do that, you know, and we're gonna keep doing that.
Yeah, until we do something about it, and you know, it's gonna be a big step to. And I don't think that Biden has that capability. Nor do I think that Trump does it at this stage in his life either, for that matter. So
it boggles my mind why a guy like Andrew Yang, I've always thought he was a really interesting political figure. Again,
he's interesting. He's very dim-witted in my opinion, but he's interesting. I think he struggles mightily with his proposed action, especially on the international front. He does have a lot of ideas, and I would say revolutionary for American ideas when it comes to the home front. And I'm not opposed to half of them. But when it comes to the international facing and what his changes would do to impact on a grander scale, I think he's very short-sighted in that regard and the enemies he would make.
Because I mean, I guess what sort of
he also I think he simped out for either Hillary, Biden, or both at some point, which really actually diminished his support because people thought that he wasn't thought that he wasn't going to support them.
Yeah, I guess what I thought was here you have a guy that's is he a billionaire? I'm not sure if he is.
Not sure if he's a billionaire, but he's very, very wealthy. And before he came into politics,
young, like tech savvy. And a social conscience. I thought, well, this is an interesting guy that, like, on a domestic level, you might like to have him as, like, one of your, you know, as your leader. I had no, you know, I have to say, I had no idea about his foreign policy ideas and things like that. So I'm glad. But I think the idea, what I was thinking about was you got, like, two geriatrics slugging it out. Like, one guy who literally has to wear Depends. I mean, and is
one is not too far behind, if we're being honest.
Right. He probably wears like Spanx. I would say like Spanx and platform heels because the guy's a raging narcissist. I'm not opposed to some of the things that he's done. But like he's not a guy I'd probably have around for dinner either.
No, and that's the American feeling everywhere is that he might have good policy, but I'd never have him over. I'd never let him never let him date my daughter, that type of thing, right? But
yeah.
I think and I was talking about this actually on my last solo show. That isn't there a point when we reach where it's like, okay, we actually don't want any of these people. Not only do we not want them around our family, not want them to ever really meet us. These people are unelectable. And I don't know if we're as a country at that realization point, but you know, you're not going to change 2024, but beyond this, is this really the trend that we want to restart? Cause these people are clearly, they don't have the best interest, I would say, of the country.
No. Well, if anything, I guess what a Biden presidency has shown you is the president isn't that important.
Correct. Because the country's moving just fine.
You don't have a functioning human. Like, he does not have a functioning brain. You know, no matter how they try to spin it, the dude doesn't have a functioning brain at this point, like, to run a country. I mean, he can't govern his bowel movements. So, like, how important is the president, I guess? You know, it's a fiat position in one sense, right? Like, yes, there's authority connected to a signature,
I would say it's not, but I would also interject by saying it is important to at least have a good showing, because if you're supposed to be the number one power in the world, how do you have a weak leader at the front of that, especially when, you know, what we've done to the position over the past few decades, not really ever since the start of this country, it's been a push to the executive, but we've given this person so much alleged power. For them to be weak is, realistically, I say, a pretty good showing of the United States being weak in general.
Yeah.
So do with that what you will.
There's of course, conspiratorial arguments that it's been intentional on a global stage. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, okay, so the so-called globalists or whatever, like, what are they doing about China? Mm-hmm. You know, they're happy with like the U.S. being weaker. And look, the U.S. has made a lot of terrible decisions over the course of history, but they probably haven't been the most tyrannical regime that's existed on planet Earth. So
not the most. No,
there's a lot of things that if we knew, like what went on behind closed doors, we'd be wildly repulsed. But I feel as though we're headed for, I'm going to call it like a dystopian technocracy, and it's unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
It's unavoidable because of most people's addiction to technology.
It's not even an addiction at this point. It's also a reliance. And so I guess you could say that is an addiction. Yeah, dependence is a better word for it. But you could say it's an addiction, but not really when, by law, your car now needs an iPad in it. By law, you need all these electronics, not just the iPad. And if that's the case, you're not going to be able to drive if you're not okay with some sort of electronic in your life.
Right.
You're not going to be able to work with a computer. That's been the case for, I would say, over 50% of our population for quite a while now. If you don't have access to a computer, you can't work.
I mean, to be fair, hopefully it doesn't come across too hypocritical as a guy who runs an entirely virtual business. Like, I rely on a laptop, an internet connection, a webcam, and a microphone to run my business. Like, you know, but it is the medium. Like, it's my intellect that, like, my intellectual property, I guess. That's actually behind the business. But without that, I don't have a business.
Right.
So technology's done a lot of great things for us. But the problem is now, here's another slippery slope. the more hooked we are in technology, the more we hand over our power to whoever runs the technology.
Absolutely.
Like, I'm inclined to think that, like, in some ways, that Google runs the world. And because they control, they're the gatekeepers for so much of the flow of information.
Absolutely.
And so unquestionably, they can shape narratives, they can, because they control what information we get and don't get. And so as such, they don't have to be in the office of the president. They already have this power that, like,
they would rather
all government institutions. So, and you want to talk about, like, a deep state and a shadow government, like, how about like Google and that, Microsoft and
I think Amazon. That's a good conversation to end this on, John, because I think this fully puts it full circle, because you kind of gave an analysis on what 2024 looks like from the outside, but on the grander scale and what this really means. Well, in my opinion, just as you mentioned, those companies having the impact that they do, the bigger issue is that our corporations are now governments in of themselves. And I'm talking specifically about America. It's not like Canada doesn't have large corporations, but when you look at the NASDAQ, when you look at the Dow Jones, right, these companies that are made up by American companies, and the whole striving for is the biggest profit. Well, now that we have these massive conglomerates, you know, you think about Elon Musk and his holdings. You think about Jeff Bezos and his holding, and his wife and her holdings now, his ex-wife, who got half, right? And you go down the line, you have all these people, you know, I think that guy Arnault is technically the richest, but we all know there's a lot of Saudi money out there too. These are all governments in of themselves. They are hiring a lot of people to do the work for them. It's become a bureaucracy in of itself, just being in this business, these businesses. Think of Microsoft, Google, Twitter, right? All these different big headline corporations. Now you're talking about politics being involved, not just in, you know, every day-to-day life and becoming more invasive to your personal life, but it's in business, it's in everything you do now. And if you're not going to respect the overlord, so to speak, well, then you don't have a job. And not only do you not have a job, it's going to be hard for you to find another job, because you have Google stamping basically a big denial sticker on your lap and every piece you ever apply for. So that's at least my opinion of it when you talk about the companies. And I think that's how bad it's gotten.
Yeah. Well, when I say dystopian technocracy, this is kind of what I'm referring to. But that might lead to, okay, well, then what do you do? What does the average person do? The average peon, if you will. You know, what do we do? Because we don't have the resources to fight against this. So here's what I think. Like, okay, I can be a good, it starts with being a good husband. I can be a good husband, support my wife. I can be a good, upstanding father. I can teach my children values. I can teach them to think critically. I can be an upstanding member of my community. You know, these are the areas where I have some degree of influence. And so I'm not suggesting that any one person, you know, can change the world per se. But if we think about, like, what is my sphere of influence? Do we spend a lot of time and energy on things that are totally outside of our sphere of control? What can I do? And just by teaching my kids upstanding, like good moral values, and being a family man and supporting the family unit, the little unit that I essentially govern with my wife at my side. I'm not a dictator, but I just mean, like, you know, my wife happily sort of lets me take the lead on a lot of things, as long as she gets her say. You know, she happily goes, hey, look, you know, you run most things and I'm cool with that. Like, she runs the household, I run the business, and together it works. But, like, that's our area of government. That's what we have some degree of control and influence over.
Absolutely.
So if people would just, because, like I said, I could just become a nihilist and run away and I want to hide in the woods and go, like, I just give up and throw up my hands in the air.
Sure.
My act of rebellion is simply to be a good man and to foster a morally upstanding family unit and try
become
to
become a representative of what that could be to your community as well, which is massively impactful. I agree, though. I think, and this is what I've been preaching for quite a while on this show now, is what you can actually do in your own life. And it all does start, first of all, with yourself, then how you're impacting. If you don't have a wife, you don't have children, then it's what you do day in and day out. Even if you have a wife, as a man, what you do day in, day out, what you do for work, if you're not going to put your best foot forward every day, then find something that you can allow yourself to do that. Because it's so important. We kind of referenced it earlier in the show as well, but it's so important to actually have something to do and something to to kind of give your life into that's not just your family. Because you could give your whole life into your family, but if you're not bringing, as the male being the provider in this scenario, if you're not going to bring back what you're supposed to be providing, well, then you're not going to have a family much longer. That's a sad reality of it. So you best be finding passion in what you're going to do, at least somewhat. It doesn't mean you have to love your job, but it does mean you have to love doing your job right. I think that's important.
That's a great way of putting it. Not everybody gets the privilege of doing what they love
for absolutely
their profession. I'm very fortunate. I mean, most of my life I wasn't doing that, but mm-hmm. I'm now in a position where it's a possibility and a reality for me, and I'm very fortunate in that regard. But whatever it is that you do, do it with integrity and do it with like moral character. And you're right. Start with yourself. Start with being a provider, and let the things that you can't take care of, just let them go at this point in time. Don't be ignorant, be informed, but don't let it take your mental and emotional energy.
Absolutely.
Put that into what you have control over.
I couldn't agree more. John, it was awesome having you on again. Be looking out for my call, hopefully sooner than a year, because I think it'd be pretty fun to talk to you, at least after the election, if the thing actually happens at this point. And otherwise, why don't you let the people know where to find you?
Well, freedomnutritioncoach.com if you want to know about my health coaching stuff. Currently, at the time of recording this, my podcast is on hiatus, but it's called Between the Before and After. There will be a rebrand coming up in a couple months' time. But in the meantime, if you look for that, you'll find me there as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you, John. I hope all stays well. I know you're going to be busy with these couple of boys you got now. So I'll let you run off. And for everybody else, you can go check out all of our other shows we did with John, as well as our whole catalog of podcasts over somewhere over here on the screen. Until then, I'll catch you guys.
I want to be something, not nothing. Trapped inside my dream and I'm running. Running away from these demons. But the feeling's so good, I'm going to keep dreaming.